And good afternoon. Welcome back to your extended news at noon. Tracy Morgan in with you. Dr. Love is on the phone with me again. Dr. John Love, the infectious disease specialist with the Butler Health System. And welcome back, Dr. Love. I do appreciate your time as always. I know you're a very busy individual.
No problem, Tracy. Thanks. Happy to be back.
And we have talked many times throughout this pandemic. And so the focus I wanted to talk to you about today is some information that was released by the CDC. And just to kind of give a brief overview, very brief, it basically was talking about the numbers of people that died strictly from COVID-19 only. And if I have these numbers right, it was about 94% of the people had underlying conditions. Well, that would leave 6% with the people who died strictly of COVID. So I'm wondering if you can put that into perspective for us, because I'm wondering if people see that information and think the COVID numbers of deaths have been inflated and that this really isn't as big of a problem as being reported. What are your thoughts on that?
There's been a lot made of this quote-unquote story that is just kind of noise. Every death certificate has multiple lines for both kind of the imminent cause of death, the immediate cause of death, as well as things that may have contributed to the patient's death. Say, a patient who died of sepsis that was actually a result from an infected diabetic foot. The sepsis is secondary to some other medical problems that were in play well before the sepsis occurred, and the death from sepsis is unlikely to have occurred in the absence of the other factors. None of this is surprising in that we know that people with underlying medical problems have worse outcomes with COVID. So that's not surprising. I'm surprised that there are patients that only have COVID listed as the only cause of death or something on their death certificate.
Well, and that was one of the things that I thought of when I heard this information, because how many people are walking around with one of these comorbidities that they may or may not know about?
The things on the comorbidity list are basically, you know, your who's who of American medical problems.
You know,
hypertension, heart disease, diabetes, renal disease, underlying lung disease like COPD or emphysema. You know, the average American, a lot of average Americans have at least one of these. You know, we as medical providers are very in tune to these risk factors for, again, bad outcomes with COVID. And so we do our best to explain how this person may or may not have been at risk for a bad outcome based on their underlying medical problems. You know, there are people who die who don't have underlying medical problems. There are people with underlying medical problems who get COVID who, you know, do quite well and survive and have no discernible long-term adverse events. There's a lot about this disease that we don't know yet, and I think people want to jump on these numbers and understandably want to feel some reassurance that only really sick people die from this, and so therefore we don't have to worry about it, is really kind of what I read into the stories about this. And I think that downplays the number of Americans that live with these chronic medical conditions that do put them at risk from death or, you know, really prolonged hospitalizations from this infection.
Well, and I'm glad you made that point, and I'm going to shift that point also to connect it with the kids in that conversation. And I know I'd like to talk to you about kids going back to school. I don't know if that's too early to talk about, because I know school just got underway for most of the districts here in Butler County. But the thought of, well, it doesn't affect kids as much. I mean, first of all, I'm going to get on my soapbox here for a moment. So first of all, isn't one kid too many? I mean, that's just my thought, is if it affects one kid, I think that's too many. But two, even if it affects a child, do you see long-term effects afterwards, even in adults?
So there's obviously a lot that we still don't understand about this disease, and I feel like I almost need to have that tattooed on me at this point in the pandemic.
Right.
But, you know, I think what it's fair to say is that on average, children have a less severe illness if they get infected with COVID-19. There's questions about, you know, is there a different age range within children that are, you know, behave more like adults, or some studies suggest, you know, kids over 10 have syndromes that are a little more reminiscent of adults' illness, whereas under 10, there's ongoing debate about how infectious kids are to other people in their households. say if they were to be, if they were to acquire the infection in school, can they bring it home and infect their parents? Can they infect their grandparents over the weekend when they're on a visit? And there's been kind of back and forth about this. I think there are definitely negative, bad outcomes from kids with COVID. You know, the thing that has garnered a fair amount of news is the disease or the process known as MISC, or multisystem inflammatory.
I'll let you say it. I know.
Yeah,
it's a mouthful, right?
Multisystem right. inflammatory syndrome in children. And basically, it appears to be like a, not quite an autoimmune, but a pro-inflammatory over-response that can be fatal to kids. And so I've mentioned that because I think, you know, it's uncommon, and it's uncommon enough that it, you know, I think it flies under the radar. I think the other kind of concerning thing out there is the long-term sequelae from these infections is still unknown. You know, we have some fair to good data about even people with mild disease, mild infections, having MRI evidence of significant cardiac abnormalities after their infection clears. And what this means long term, I'm not sure about. No one's sure about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does this kind of damage to the heart muscle, is this going to predispose these children and adults to later having congestive heart failure, cardiomyopathy, something that's going to have morbidity with it? I don't know. But, you know, there's this signal of this concern, which I think is in the back of a lot of people's minds.
So if I could interrupt you with the inflammation,
sure.
And again, I've heard, you're the expert, that's why I'm asking you, does COVID affect more people who have inflammation or who are overweight? Now, I want to ask specifically about inflammation, if that's true. So, I want to know if that's true or not. But what is inflammation? Because I know if somebody says, well, you know, my elbow hurts because of my arthritis. Is that inflammation, or are we talking about inflammation at a cellular level?
So, when I don't know that there's, you know, any data to say that people with inflammation from, say, an autoimmune process or another infectious process are at higher risk for either acquiring COVID or a bad outcome from COVID. Inflammation, when we speak about it with COVID, so the COVID infection, like a lot of viral infections, creates an inflammatory response, which is kind of the non-specific arm of the immune system. The issue with COVID is that it seems to trigger a pathologic inflammatory response in some people, meaning it's an over-exuberant inflammatory activity, which can cause damage to other organ systems. And so it's kind of uncontrolled. And there are even patients who develop a syndrome that looks very much like toxic shock syndrome, with they can't maintain their blood pressure. They have massive influxes of cytokines, which are chemicals made by the immune system to respond to infections, and it's overkill. And the host ends up being hurt more by the overkill inflammatory response than the direct viral response. Not every patient ends up down that path. Yeah, that is definitely a trajectory that some patients do. And so there's your garden variety inflammation from a rheumatoid arthritis or something like that versus, you know, this overwhelming pathologic inflammatory response with hypotension and requiring intensive care level medicines just to keep someone supported through.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, in layman's terms, if you're saying it's an overkill, is that the overkill of the body's response to the COVID being in the system?
Yes. Yeah. So it's, and again, this is not every person, but there is a subset of people that I think we have not yet defined their risk factors or the reasons that they develop this, but that seem to get really an overabundant or over-aggressive inflammatory response. Typically, it's well into the illness, so it's after they've already, you know, had their fever and their cough. It's a later event, which makes it even more difficult to predict.
So let me go back to the point you were trying to make with the death certificates, if you will, because this is a conversation that I have been involved in, surprisingly, more than one time since the last time I've talked to you. I'll take a different approach with the earlier point that was made. if a person has diabetes but dies from the heart attack, you know, what's on the death certificate? Is it the diabetes or the heart attack? And so when you look at COVID, I've had this conversation where people say, well, someone died from a heart attack, but then they tested the body and then it had COVID. So then COVID's on the death certificate. Could you explain that? What's on the death certificate?
So I don't know how many people are really being tested post-mortem for COVID. There are definitely cases, or there are definitely processes like strokes, like cardiac arrhythmias, which would be garden variety causes of death last year. But this year, you know, they may be tied to COVID. You know, we do know that COVID causes a clotting problem. We do know that it causes some cardiac arrhythmia problems, or it can. The arrhythmia or the MI or the heart attack, mm-hmm. or the stroke may be the cause of the patient's death, but
in certain cases,
that's only telling half the story.
I was going to say, I know we have like just a few minutes, right? And I need you to explain the whole thing. But in that kind of case, could that? And I'm just saying, could that death not have happened if COVID wasn't in the system?
It may have. Would it have happened that day? That's the question.
Okay.
You have someone walking around with the high blood pressure and the diabetes and the known coronary disease and cholesterol problems. And, if I saw them walking down the street and I knew those things, I'd say, you know, the chances are they're going to have a heart attack at some point again. But it may be the COVID that kind of instigates, you know, the thrombosis that leads to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, they were set up for it, sure. Would that have happened without the COVID infection? Unclear. And so that's. I think it's better that we cast a wide net so that we understand how the different ways this virus may be impacting our population, rather than being, you know, like the only deaths we're going to attribute to this are young, healthy 20-somethings with no medical problems. Okay, that's not the population that's going to die. You know, it is the patients in the nursing homes who have multiple medical problems. It is our weakest, frailest people that are at the highest risk, and we have to stop excusing COVID deaths just because patients are old or have other medical problems. That's not a reason to not care about someone's death.
Yeah, in my wheelhouse is when I hear people talk about, well, it's only so many deaths. I'm thinking, again, isn't one death too many? You know, but anyway, that's just my own opinion, and I'm not asking for your thoughts on my own opinion, but that's my own opinion. Anyway, let me ask you just a couple other quick questions, if
sure.
I could. And one is about wearing masks. Another conversation, well, let me just put, I don't understand this, where there are some places that are trying to, you know, get back to business, if you will, and having people back in. And I understand the thought, people are trying. But my confusion is this. Let's say somebody is at a particular location, and they're supposed to wear their masks, we'll say, through the hallways. But yet when they're at a table in an office and they're sitting across from the same people, they can take their masks off. Aren't we in the same air? Aren't we breathing the same thing?
Yeah, I think some of these guidelines can be a little...
I mean, they're trying. I understand that they're trying. Right, right.
And, you know, I look at things like, all right, you know, going out to eat at a restaurant and, you know, you're walking through the dining room to get to your table, you wear your mask until you sit down, then you're allowed to take your mask off. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If I'm dining with just with people that I live with at home, there's no real difference in risk to them than if we were sitting at a table at home. Right. The server, however, is now encountering multiple people that are not masked. They're wearing a mask. But if one of the people at the table has a pre-symptomatic infection, you know, the server's at risk. I think we try to make these rules so that people can you know, start to have some semblance of normal life and businesses can get back to work. But none of them is going to be as effective at control of COVID as social distancing and not doing these things. And I think there's going to be different acceptance of different risk levels. And I think what we just need to be aware of is when we're putting someone else at risk just because of our own choices. And that's where I think it's lost with this sometimes.
One more question for you, if you don't mind. As we're talking about trying to move forward and trying to have people back in their business, and I'm not trying to pick on any particular business, I understand outside we can socially distance and we can do that easily if you have the room and the space. But I heard one person say to me the other day, I think we're over the hump. And I'm thinking, are we? I mean, where are we with this?
I feel like we are... Either you could either say we're at equilibrium or we're just in a quagmire, I think, depending on how you want to look
right,
at it.
Right.
I think, you know, this is, you know, we found ways to kind of slow spread. I think we're still going to keep seeing cases. It's not going away anytime soon. You know, I think our control efforts are largely, you can have success. We still see outbreaks, you know, related to social gatherings and things like that, where people break these down. So this isn't going to go away. You know, are we over the hump? I mean, we don't have herd immunity, if that's what someone means by over the hump. You know, we still have the vast majority of the population that would be vulnerable to this virus if they encounter it. And so our efforts have to be at keeping the majority of these people, especially the most vulnerable, from encountering this virus, if at all possible.
Yeah.
And that's really, you know, what we need to keep working on. So, yeah, I mean, we're over the hump when you look at the number of cases. Would you graph them out? Sure. That's what Allegheny County, you know, thought when they looked, you know, back to April and then started opening things up. And then, oh, look, you have a new hump.
Yeah.
So it can still happen. It's just how our behaviors are going to drive that or what we have control over.
I can't let you go without asking about the vaccines.
Yeah.
Of course, the story's out there. Do you have one by November? Do you not? How does this go? What's your expert opinion on vaccines?
So, you know, I am always pro-vaccine when the vaccine is well-vetted, well-studied, has gone through what is a very rigorous approval process at the FDA when it goes through the normal approval channels. You know, this has to show not just safety and efficacy, but some follow-up over a period of time, you know, for adverse events. And I get a little, I am skeptical that a vaccine could get to the general population by, let's pick a random day, November 3rd, without avoiding or short-tracking some of the usual safety studies or reviews. So I'm watching this saying, I think there's a lot of promise in the vaccine developments. There are many trials going on with some very promising candidate vaccines. We have had candidate vaccines for lots of viral infections in the past, including HIV, that have not gone anywhere once they've actually been rolled out to efficacy trials. And a lot of the vaccine platforms that might be the earliest to the general public would be new platforms, meaning types of vaccines that we do not currently have licensed. And so I think there's going to be a lot of discussion around what is this thing that is being offered? Has it been appropriately vetted, and how safe do Americans feel with it? I'm hoping that I'm able to stand behind something and say, "Yep, this is great. I think this went through the appropriate channels. This sounds like, you know, this is based on good science and good studies, you know, and I think we can use this," as opposed to something where it says, like, "I feel like this is pushed through. I think it works. I hope it works. Here's what we know about safety for what period of time." It may be something where we have to say, listen, this is what we know and this is what we don't, and have a individual conversation with each patient about where their safety comfort zone is.
So it's a big conversation. I know we'll continue
rough.
That one as we go yeah. along. My goodness. Dr. John Love, of course, infectious disease specialist at the Butler Health System. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you for all that you're doing. I know we talked to the school districts a couple of weeks ago, and they were mentioning that you were a part of their discussions, and they appreciated you as well. So thank you for being in the community to help us as well.
My pleasure. I'm, I, you know, my best wishes for safety and success to the schools, the students, and the teachers, because they have a daunting task ahead of them, and I already started for some.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for your time. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Tracy.